I applied to 5 colleges, but Howard was always the goal. I got into all 5 colleges I applied to, including Howard, into their honors English program. I was thrilled. My dad was not.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I am Jessica Hinken. And today on the podcast, we are returning to the Stoop. This is the second episode in which we feature a memorable Stoop story and explore various fascinating questions with the storyteller. Before we get started, we want to thank the Park School of Baltimore, which is a pre-K through grade 12 non-sectarian progressive school, theoretically located right outside of Baltimore. But right now, it's like every school, it's virtual. Okay. Laura, who do we have today?
So today we are featuring a story and conversation with Petula Caesar. So this story was originally shared at a show that we did in October of 2018. And the show was called Getting It Wrong, Stories About Mix-Ups, Mistakes, and Misunderstandings. What we're going to do now is listen to Petula's story from 2 years ago, which feels like a world away at this point in time. And then we're going to chat with her.
For as long as I can remember, I always wanted to attend Howard University in Washington, D.C. Howard University is an HBCU, which stands for Historically Black Colleges and Universities. I wanted to go there, be in their honors English program, and become a writer. I applied to 5 colleges, but Howard was always the goal. I got into all 5 colleges I applied to, including Howard, into their honors English program. I was thrilled. My dad was not. My dad was born very early 20th century, very light-skinned, straight-haired, white-presenting African-American man. And he learned very early in his life that to be successful and to survive, it was going to be important for the white men in the town he lived in to like him. So he became deferential. He became docile. He became bright, but not too bright, never too threatening. And in behaving that way, along with his white appearance, the white men took a liking to him. He got jobs that paid well. He was able to secure his family financially. So he wanted that for me also. That meant no black things in our house. No black music, no black literature, as much as I love to read. He was a painter. He never painted black people, and there was no black art in our house. I was always told to make sure I spoke the king's English at all times. He was a little disappointed with the hair, but he kept me in the salon a lot, so he kept me bone straight. So when I got into Howard, he started saying things like, "Are you sure a black university is going to challenge you academically? You know, the world's not really black. The world is really white. And you're going to be in D.C. alone. You're going to be okay. And most importantly, as much grief as black people have given you," which they had because they had teased you all my life, "don't you want to finally get away from them?" So he talked to me this way all summer. By the time the third week of August rolled around, I was moving into the dorms at Towson State University, my fifth choice school. I hated Towson. It was awful. I didn't want to be there. I immediately started flunking all of my classes. It was bad. I was devastated because I'd never done poorly in school, but there was one bright, shining light at Towson, my roommate, complete opposite of me, blonde, blue-eyed, well-to-do family, grew up in a little town on the Jersey Shore. But we bonded immediately. We had so much in common, loved the same books, the same writers. We liked the wine a whole lot. We listened to the same music. We just got along. We shared clothes. We shared makeup. We were best friends. And she always encouraged me to try to stick it out at school. My boyfriend was also worried that I was so unhappy. So he came to visit me one Saturday to try to cheer me up, and my roommate said, "Why don't we do a double date?" So she, the guy she was seeing, my boyfriend and I, went out off campus, had a great time. Boys brought us back to our room. My roommate turned to me once the boys left and said, "Do your parents mind you dating a black guy?" "Why would they?" "Well, my parents are pretty liberal, but I think if I brought a black guy home, they'd be pretty upset." "Sure they would be. What's that got to do with me?" It took a couple of rounds of this for me to realize what was happening. She thought I was white. So I had to stop her. This was awful. So I said, hold up. I am not white. That's why my parents don't mind me dating a black guy. Her eyes got really big. Then she squinted and she looked at me for a long time and she said, Petula, why didn't you tell me? And I said, why did I have to tell you? And she said, I've never met a black person. I mean, look at you. Look at how, listen to how you talk. You listen to Queen and David Bowie, for God's sake. You know so much about wine, and why would I think you're black? I mean, look at you. And she went over to the bed where I had a couple of articles of her clothing that I'd borrowed, and she snatched them off the bed, and she went to my desk, and there were a couple of makeup items I'd borrowed. She snatched them off the desk, and she looked at this bottle of CoverGirl foundation, and she said, I can't believe a black girl wears the same color foundation as me. I can't believe you deceived me this way. And she stormed out of the room to tell the other girls in the quad, who were also white girls, that I had lied about being white. I'm devastated. This is my best friend. This is my only friend. Why did she think I was white? Why was she upset that I wasn't? Why did she feel deceived? And then I started to think, had I presented myself in a way subconsciously that so that she would like me, or had I done something? But the one thing I was sure about was this wouldn't have happened to me at Howard University. So I decided I was going to leave Towson, and I went home for Thanksgiving break to tell my dad I could not go back. As fate would have it, my dad took sick that Thanksgiving, and he was in the hospital for quite a while, for months actually. When he came out and he was on the road to recovery, I told him what had happened to me out at Towson. And my dad looked at me and said, she thought you were white? Really? Well, why did you tell her you weren't? And that's when I realized I really needed to stop listening to my dad. Thank you for your time.
All right, that was Petula Caesar's story. And before we get started with the discussion, we want to thank our sponsors for the podcast, Golden West, which is located on the Avenue in Hamden. And they have a vegan, Southwestern, delicious menu, as well as outdoor and curbside options. Check them out, Golden West Cafe.
And we want to thank Baltimore Magazine, which you can find on the newsstand or at baltimoremagazine.com. They do a great job of covering all the events and news and good stuff and hard stuff in the city. So check out Baltimore Magazine. Okay, so when I listened to that story again, Petula, I was struck by how funny it was.
Well, I think like most good stories, there are a lot of layers to it. I think on the surface response, which I think is the laughter, and plus I do sort of tell it in kind of an amusing kind of way, or that's what I was going for anyway. So there's definitely some humor in it. But I do think, at least from folks that have talked to me about the story, that it's the kind of thing that you laugh at it initially, but it stays with you. And then later on, you kind of pick it back up and examine it a little more closely. And perhaps it doesn't seem quite as funny, or the humor has some other elements to it. Is it the kind of laugh that you might laugh when you're uncomfortable about something? Mm-hmm. So, you know, laughter isn't always just about, you know, being amused by something. You know, laughter kind of can even sort of hide a person's discomfort around a topic or a set of circumstances or whatever. And from talking to folks about the story afterwards, what most people's response was that the way I told it was funny, and there were surface elements about it that were funny, but after they thought about it a bit more, they weren't entirely sure the laughter was that amused kind of laughter.
Yeah.
What do you think? I mean, you have that last line that's like, I decided then I shouldn't listen to my father anymore, but like, he was telling you how to survive. And when you listen to it now, it's like,
Well, he was telling you how he thinks you should survive, right? Yeah. So just like, that's the difference, right?
Yeah. He was speaking from a very particular set of circumstances, a very particular kind of experience. And it was his presumption that I would have the exact same kind of experience. So my response to it should be exactly what his response was when he ran into those similar kinds of circumstances. The story now at this stage of my life has a lot of humor in it just because I've had the opportunity to live a decent amount of years and to have had a lot of experiences and a lot of things happen to me. So my perspective on it now is that I see the humor in it, but I see the other things in it too. So yes, it still strikes me as funny in a lot of ways, which is probably why I present it the way that I do. But I do also see my father's perspective and how at the time it really impacted me in a way that made it difficult for me to handle what happened in the story. Certainly if that same thing happened to me now, my response would be completely different. So
what would your response be now?
In these days and times, how I feel about race-related discussion really varies from day to day. Some days I feel very patient and I'm very much in teacher instructional mode and I really don't mind having discussions about things related to race and in this case, colorism specifically. Other days I'm like, look, Google it, okay? What's wrong with
it? Yeah.
So it really kind of depends on what day it is, but I can say every day, if I were in this circumstance today, I would not see it as a reflection of myself or something I had done wrong. I really internalized the experience when it happened. It had something to do with me, my presentation, my actions. I understand now that how people respond to you at the bare minimum says as much about them as it does about anything. I get that now. When I was 18 and trying to figure out myself in the world, I didn't understand that at all.
I'm so curious to know if you have had any, if she's attempted to ever reach out to you through social media.
Okay. Has she ever attempted to reach out to me?
Through social media. Like, right, have you ever come across her Facebook presence or?
No, I have not. Now, mind you, this was years ago. The last name may be different at this point. It seems like everyone is on social media, but there are some people who aren't. But she has not reached out to me. I would not feel comfortable reaching out to her about a particular thing.
No, it's for her to reach out.
The fact that she hasn't reached out, in my head, I believe that for her, I doubt honestly that she remembers this incident. I feel it would be just kind of a vague recollection of that girl she roomed with in college ever so briefly, don't know what happened to her. I would be surprised if that incident really registered on her radar in any significant way. I really would. So.
Yeah. I think you're probably right, you know, or she tells it as like, a story of someone not being entirely truthful at best and deceitful at worst, you know? And it's just, you know, the confusion. And also I wonder, like, you were so surprised that she didn't know, like you were surprised by her surprise.
Yes.
And I guess when I am assuming that one of the functions of getting older is like, you might not be surprised if this happened now. It's like, I don't know. What do you think?
I think I was surprised then because I had never had that experience before. Although I am very light-skinned, to my knowledge, no one had ever been under the impression I was white, to my knowledge. Having come out of an experience where how I presented didn't cause anyone to identify me incorrectly. To then have that experience, I just didn't know people. It shocked me that there were people who would not be able to ascertain that I was not white, regardless of what I looked like or how I behaved or whatever. I think it would still shock me now, because I guess in my head, I just can't imagine a person who's just had such a, I can't imagine a person in these days and times living an existence where everyone they see looks exactly like them. Although I guess there are people that do. I just can't imagine it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think I would still be a little bit surprised. I wouldn't be shocked, but I just find it surprising and even a little saddening, I guess, that there are people who live in a world where it doesn't require them to not consider things outside of their own experience.
Would you say that this experience allowed you to feel more comfortable at Howard subsequently? Like, had you not had this experience at Towson, do you think your experience at Howard would have been different in any way?
I think I definitely appreciated it more. I kind of after this happened, I really retreated into my family, familiar things, Black things, because I really needed those things, because at the time I felt that something I was doing was leading people to believe something about me that wasn't true. So,
Oh my God. That's such a difficult, uncomfortable position. Like, what am I doing that's causing people to think something about me that isn't true? I have felt that at times in my life, and that is a feeling that will make you want to go crazy, you know?
Yeah. And I definitely did go crazy after a while. So when I came home from Towson, I looked in the mirror, I just examined every fiber of my being and my existence. And I was for about a year afterwards, I went through this very super Black thing where I started wearing an afro, and I read a lot of really like militant books, and I just went through, like, I need to be Blacker. This can't ever happen to me again. And I don't want to assimilate. And I just became like hyper militant for a while, just kind of overcompensating. But that's exhausting.
Yeah.
I've always found everything that requires you not to be yourself is probably going to wear you out at some point. It wore me out pretty quickly, thankfully, so not too many people got to see me being stupid like that. So I eventually kind of mellowed out and settled down, and thankfully.
It seems so understandable, though. It's like, oh, let me go ahead and lean in the other way so that I'll never happen again. But it's still theatrical. It's theatrical in some way, because you're trying to overemphasize these things that are possibly confusing about yourself, which doesn't ultimately, like you said, it's exhausting. It's a performance still.
Yeah. So eventually I just kind of started settling into a place where I was going to be who I was, and some of the things that I am are definitely related to how I identify racially, and some things about me aren't as connected to that. And that is perfectly fine, but there definitely was a period where I had to untangle a lot of things, and it was difficult at the time.
And you have children, right? Or you have you have one kid. Yeah. So have you told this story to them?
Yes, I have told the story to my daughter and my son. My daughter, like me, is very light-skinned. And so for her, it's an experience. She's had similar experiences. So it's something that kind of really resonates with her and some of the issues she's had in terms of how she identifies racially and how other people perceive that. My son really didn't understand it at all. To him, the idea that, first, that someone would think I was white, secondly, that they would be upset about that and feel offended or feel that they had been deceived, he thought was just ridiculous. And he, when I told him the story, he kept asking, well, why is she overreacting? She made a mistake.
Wow.
What's the problem? And that is a good question. I have no answers.
Is it reassuring to you that he's able to see it from that perspective? Because I mean, that is the most mature,
sort of like what's humanistic, the big deal?
Yeah,
like yeah,
right. I do appreciate that he has a sort of straightforwardness about him that I really do appreciate. He's very good at cutting to the chase, and he is right. I mean, even with all of the weight of the racial parts of the equation, ultimately she made a presumption based on very limited information that she interpreted incorrectly, and it was that simple. And there was certainly space to, you know, take a different path, but because she was just so, you know, she felt very strongly about her beliefs and her perceptions, and anything beyond that had to be a lie, had to be untrue, and therefore I was a liar. And it's funny to me, the fact that she thought that was something that one would lie about really confused me in the moment. I didn't get that, but in her presumption, you know, of course I would lie about something like that, because the truth was just too ugly to be born.
Yeah.
So there was just a lot there that at the time really confused me. But as my son put it, you know, she made a mistake. Why wasn't she okay with that?
She couldn't, because her brain was exploding, because you guys were wearing the same shade of highlighter.
Yes, she was very, very...
And her foundation.
Her foundation. I think that of all the things that were happening in that moment, the fact that we wore the same color foundation really was just destroying her world at that time. That we were the same skin color.
Yeah.
She was just horrifying. I think she felt a little violated even that we were the same color.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's like in my perception of her, I remember this the night of, she's at once this, and it's not unlike how, you know, I don't mean to politicize this, but how I view many people in the far right or in the Republican Party. It's like at once they seem like a villain, and on another level, they just seem so ridiculous, like so mockable, so fear-based. And, you know, and it's hard to see any redeeming qualities about her, but yet she was someone that you were really close with. So
yes, this was my lifeline at Towson. I was there, not under my own steam. It was a place I did not want to be. And that's certainly not Towson's fault that I did not want to be there. Every now I talk to Towson alums and I feel like I need to say that. So no, it wasn't the school's fault necessarily. I shouldn't have been there. I didn't want to be there. I was having a hard time adjusting. And here was this person, my roommate, saw me and was willing to give me pep talks and who tried to encourage me to continue my studies when I was really feeling defeated. And even when I think about our time before the incident, I do remember things about her that I genuinely liked and appreciated. And I certainly, so there were some white people at the high school I went to. I went to high school in Baltimore City, but I'd never been super close to them. So this was the first white person that I'd really had a close relationship with. So there was kind of the weight of that, especially when we butted heads ultimately.
Right. And it's a bit, it's like a breakup. It's like a breakup that you couldn't control.
Yeah.
It came out of nowhere. And then you, because this is what we all do at that age, but not, you know, not everyone has this added, you internalized it. And then, that you overcame this and you are such a badass. I mean, this is not, of course, like there are harder obstacles, but this has made you, I think, a person who it enhanced your empathy and your sense of humor and your kindness to yourself. Like once you got on the other side of this, but I would wonder how you, and I, this might be a hard question, but I would, I would think if I were in your shoes, I would be really reticent to trust white women. I would feel that would be a hard pill to swallow.
Quite honestly, I think most Black people are reticent to trust white women. No disrespect to one of you.
I know.
But having the personal experience to enhance the mythology of white women that Black people get told before they have their personal experiences, having that sort of real time experience kind of supported the information I had been given before I met this person. So it did not help your case, no.
But we're the exception, right?
Oh, no, we're not. Jesus, we all have a lot of work to do. I'm kidding.
Well, I think one of the most difficult, one of the reasons we're having so much difficulty in any kind of race discussion right now is the necessity of understanding a structural, institutionalized set of conditions that make life more challenging for a particular group of people versus whether Jessica's a nice person.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, those conversations, like, I understand why some days you're like, Google it, you know, read a book. I'm not your fucking teacher. You know, I get it. And, you know, for me, what's so rich about this story and why it has stayed in my mind and I've returned to it often thinking about it, is that it encompasses so much truth about race, like the confusion, the complete subjectivity of what is it Black, what is it to be Black, what is it to be Black, white, the absurdity, the way that it as a system destroys and intrudes upon personal relationships, you know, all these things, and more, but they're all contained in this like one experience, you know. And I love how this story captures that, and that you can tease out all of these things from it, and they're all there, like you said, the layers, and all the different emotions that are, besides, you know, it is funny, it's absurd, it's stupid, it raises all the, nobody knows what Black is and what white is, you know, states can't decide on that, they never have been able to, there's not a different, you know, it's at one level very dumb and another level so destructive, you know, it's just, anyway, that's what I find about this story, that you are able to hold all of that,
right,
and convey all that, and it's brilliant that way.
Yeah, and I mean, at the time I was 18, and you know, again, with the idea that, keeping in mind that Black people are not a monolith, I was raised a very particular way in my Black household before I came to the school. My dad was very much a believer in aspiring to whiteness.
Right.
So he raised me with the belief that I should want to be all these things that white people are, and that it's a good thing to achieve these things. And for him, it was a very sort of mythical kind of 1950s, 1960s idea of whiteness, you know, lots of lace and classical music and opera and ballet attending and artworks on the wall type of, I don't even think that really exists for most white people, honestly, but my dad's belief. And it is what he set me up to be a part of. And going to Towson was going to support that. So I wasn't raised as a super aware, woke, as they would say, militant Black person. There are some Black people even my complexion, who would have walked into the situation, had this experience, and let's just say responded a lot differently than I because of how I was raised, I responded the way that I did, was to internalize it, take it very personally, to feel very hurt and very unvalued. There were other friends of mine at the time who were 18 in that same set of circumstances. It could have been different. But again, the experiences I bought to it because of how I was raised colored my response when she said I had racially deceived her.
What would you say now? Because your father's statement, was definitely, it was pivotal, I think it sounds like, in your story, for you to take a different path, to say like, I'm going to go a different way. What would you say to either of your children if they said that they had this situation happen to them?
Man, first I'd say again, but my daughter has had some of these situations where she was mistaken for something other than Black. And honestly, at the time, she did not correct the individual. And when I asked her why, she said it just seemed easier to allow them to make their incorrect presumptions and to just kind of go along. And she didn't want to rock the boat. Mm. And at the time, I felt like I really had failed as a mother, because obviously one of my jobs is to equip my children to face the world successfully. And I had not. So we talked about it a good bit. And I understand that my daughter does not like to kick up a fuss. She is still learning as she goes through her 20s that it is absolutely necessary to sometimes. She even asked me, why did I insist on telling my roommate? Why didn't I just go along with it? And I had to explain to her that it was dishonest, and I wasn't going to be dishonest for what purpose? So my daughter now, who was older than when the incident I just mentioned, her response to it would be different now. But when she had a similar experience, when she was about 18, she took a different path. She just allowed the person to believe. They wanted the impression she was Greek. So she allowed them to just kind of believe that.
Huh. So tell us, where are you now? What are you doing?
Okay. Since I was on the stoop with my story, I actually have published a book, and this story is actually in that book. I published it shortly after the stoop series in October. On a professional front, I actually took on a job as the director of community engagement with the Baltimore Rock Opera Society. They've been a part of the Baltimore artistic community for over 10 years, and they've definitely made their mark and had a decent amount of success doing live original rock operas, but they are a very white organization.
Yep.
And that shouldn't be the case in a place that is not completely white. So one of my roles there is to figure out what this organization, the Baltimore Rock Opera Society, can do to be more reflective of the community that it is a part of. Baltimore is a majority Black city. So part of that has meant looking at their programming and trying to be a bit more diverse, inclusive, bring something different to the table in terms of what they do as far as live entertainment goes. So we are doing a series of online concert series. The first one is going to be on July the 1st. They're going to be streamed on the Baltimore Rock Opera Society Facebook page, stream live. And we're going to be talking about the history of rock opera music. And we're going to start by talking about the history of rock and roll. And a lot of very important, impactful Black people were erased from that history. So we're coming out guns blazing and having a concert that's going to celebrate those Black artists who really didn't get the accolades that they should have when they were performing. And from there, we're going to move on and talk about how rock opera got started and where it's heading in the future. And I am producing the shows, and the conversations we're having in those production meetings really are a microcosm of a lot of the conversations that are happening about race in the world. So it's really been a good thing for everybody concerned, and it's going to be an amazing show. I encourage everyone to check it out, and it's going to be on the internet, so it'll be there forever. If you can't catch the live stream, you can always find it on the Facebook page for the Baltimore Rock Opera Society or on their website.
Color of my skin, I'm a girl that likes to sing.
I love this story because there's so much packed into it, and I think about it a lot, and there's a lot of questions in here, not a lot of answers, and a lot of emotions, a lot of, you know, collision between the personal and the political and the present and the past and all that stuff. And I just love that we're having the chance to talk with you to tease out some of that stuff. And I'm so glad to hear all the great work you're doing now, too. It's awesome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been good. And it's been good to hear from both of you during this time when you just don't know how folks are doing sometimes. Yeah. I'm both doing well.
We're hanging in there. We're trying.
I'm not going to say that, but we're hanging in.
Okay.
We recognize that we are two white women that have a lot of work to do. So that's what we're trying to do in general. But we're also just humans who have a lot of work to do. So
<Yeah.
laughs> we're all getting through
before
it together.
Before we get out of here, we want to thank The Wine Source, which has been a great sponsor of the Stoop podcast. And you can find them in Hamden. They have all sorts of goodies and bits of drink. And we want to thank Maureen Harvey, who is our producer for the podcast and helps us sound as good as we do. And any ways in which we don't sound good have to do with us and not with Maureen Harvey or Petula. So we take full responsibility for that. If you want to learn more about us, you can find us at stoopstorytelling.com. And please tune in next week for another story and storyteller when we continue the series Return to the Stoop.
Have a good week.
I can't lie, I can't lie. All these years of my life. Just